I was thinking that the phrase first among equals might have been coined for the string quartet, which is the most intimate, I think, of all musical forms, and the sense that every voice of all those four voices is of equal weight and importance. With me are one half of the Elias String Quartet, Mary Bitloch, whose sister Sarah plays first violin in the quartet. You play cello, so you're the anchor on the bottom line. And Donald Grant, who is the second violin, and your colleague Martin Saving. So tell us about the name, first of all, because, you know, the German for the prophet Elijah. I mean, how and why was it chosen?
It was chosen when Sarah joined the group, and the first piece we played together was a Mendelssohn quartet, and we very quickly established a close relationship to him and his music. And so we wanted to find a link to him, and all agreed that we liked Elias.
Yeah, that much-loved oratorio. This business of the intimacy, having your sister as, you know, having a familial connection in the quartet, how has that changed the dynamic?
I think probably having any member changes the dynamic a lot in a group. It was always something obvious between us. And I remember thinking, you know, yeah, one day maybe we should play together.
Yeah, it's a very particular kind of chemistry, isn't it?
Yeah, and it was kind of despite different study patterns and different teachers and different influences, which obviously has been much developed now since we've played together in a quartet, which is, as you say, the most intimate way to do chamber music.
Were you the founding members, the two of you? Donald, when did you come in?
I was a founding member along with Marie, and that was in 1998. And we were students at that point, so it was really a student quartet, and we were using it as a kind of tool to learn and get experience. And it was only 4 years in that we decided to really try and be a quartet. And so it was a year after that that Sarah joined.
I always think when I come across a second violinist in a quartet, I always think of the story that Zygmunt Nissel once told me from the Amadeus. He said a woman rushed up to him at the end of a concert and said, "Oh, please, can I see your violin?" And so he thought, well, she's obviously interested in what kind of violin I play. And so he showed her and explained where it came from. And she said, "Oh," she said, "so exciting." She said, "I've never seen a second violin before."
yeah.
So that old chestnut. How significant has the Borletti-Buttoni Trust been in your development as a quartet?
Well, basically, they have allowed us to put this whole Beethoven project together. It's with their support that we've designed the website, but also I feel extremely lucky that we are able to present a Beethoven cycle on our own terms. And certainly, the Borletti-Buttoni Trust has allowed us to do that with all the forward planning.
The 16 Beethoven quartets, like the symphonies, they're really a kind of odyssey, although they are stretched over quite a period of time, during which time, of course, you know, he lost his hearing. That interests me quite a lot. There's the before and during and after. One aspect of your project website, which is a first, I've never come across a group that actually built a website around a specific project. Why did you decide to let people have this insight into your creative process, your working process? Because that's quite an intimate thing.
We felt that often the audience only sees the final product and the concert, but actually there's so much that comes before that. So to try and involve them, get them to get to know the music more, get to know us a bit, and a website seemed the easiest way to do that.
Mm. Is there a danger that we focus on the extraordinary late quartets at the expense of the earlier quartets?
I know that why a Beethoven cycle works so well in live situation is that the early and the middle and the late, they go so well together to make a very complete programme. So you have the complete contrast between the Opus 18s and then the late quartets. So I think that's why it's maybe a Beethoven cycle is quite unique in that way. You get this very complete programme. So hopefully in that way it will highlight what each kind of period has to offer, rather than, I don't think one will just overshadow, because I think they're just so incredibly different.
Well, it is a changing journey, isn't it? The music, you can follow these big changes that took place in the music. And on your website, there is a feature, isn't there, about the hearing issue with Beethoven. It's quite interesting that Stravinsky, who made a famous comment about Grosse Fuga, which, you know, the finale of the Opus 130, that it was absolutely contemporary, and contemporary forever were his words. But he also made a comment which was passed down to me by a conductor who was a boy when he was performing in Los Angeles, and Stravinsky was involved in a project, and someone was playing the Hammerklavier Sonata, and Stravinsky, he overheard him saying, you know, this piece is all about acoustics. And he couldn't work out what he was meaning for some time. Then he realised that it's kind of, what he meant was the acoustic was kind of written into, inside his head. He couldn't hear it anymore, but it was kind of written into the music, and experimenting with sound in that way. I think that's really interesting.
Yeah.
Does that apply to the quartets, do you think, in any way?
Absolutely. I feel that emotionally. You really have the sense of this man who was living in his own world. And if he hadn't been isolated in the way he was, maybe his music would have been completely different.
Mm-hmm. And there is this improvisatory feeling about the music as well. And it's almost as if, you know, the music starts to rule the man as opposed to the other way around.
Yeah. It's like almost his deafness set him free, maybe. And you might assume that the opposite would happen, but actually it didn't. It just kind of made everything bigger, made his whole world bigger.
Now, those decisions that you make, interpretative decisions about tempo, articulation, the famous metronome markings, how do you, as a group of four people, make these decisions? I mean, obviously, you have to be democratic. Or do you?
Well, I guess...
He smiles.
There's two questions in this, but the first one, just about the metronome marks, I think we all pretty much agree in the quartet that they are really informative. But again, going back to maybe the deafness, or they are tempo markings that are thought. Mm. And I've always found there's a difference about how I would sing something to myself and how I would play it.
That's interesting.
It's just it's not much, but there's always a little bit of a difference.
That's very interesting.
So I would certainly take them as really important guidelines.
They were there for a reason.
But they're not chains, you know.
Yeah. Oh, sure. I mean, you know, there is interpretative license, obviously, with even the greatest composers. Donald, I mean, do you find that you disagree sometimes, and how do you resolve that?
Yeah, we do disagree sometimes, and I think that's a really healthy thing. We are four individuals making music together and trying to sound as one, and I think we've always celebrated our differences. Actually, we try different things. We might sit one day and say, well, tonight let's try it this way, which might be, you know, my way. Tonight we'll try it Donald's way. And then the next night we'll try it Sarah's way and see how they work in a live context.
Playing rather than talking, that surely is the way in, isn't it? Otherwise, you can talk till the cows come home, but if it actually doesn't
I think
happen
so.
When you play.
Sometimes words can get in the way
because,
you know, our ability to put across what we're feeling on our instruments is actually of a higher level than our vocabulary, you know. But at some point, sometimes something might not be quite working and you can very quickly resolve it if you just have a word for what character you're thinking. Rather than talking dynamic or bow stroke or whatever, you just say, what are you feeling here? What character is it? And it's amazing, sometimes you put your finger on that and the music becomes very clear.
Mm. You'd rather be playing now, wouldn't you? Than... I can
sense it. It would be more in my comfort zone.
think it's possible to overwork these pieces? Because that spirit of improvisation is a great key factor of this music, I think. You just never, you can't second guess it, can you? Particularly as the later quartets.
I'd say it's more about leaving doors open, and also on the day of the concert, leaving ourselves open to do something completely different to what we've been rehearsing.
Donald, do you surprise yourself sometimes, do you think, in performance, where you might, something may happen that takes you in a slightly different direction?
Yeah, often there's, you know, a bit of a giggle or a smile on stage because someone's tried out something different and you weren't expecting it, but I love that, I kind of thrive off it.
Tell us how the cycle will evolve. It all begins late September, October. Where and how are you choosing to present these works? What's your thinking behind the way? And presumably not just chronological, you're actually mixing them.
Yeah, it actually begins November, December.
Okay.
And we have six concerts. We split the quartets into six concerts, six full concerts, and we have various cycles starting this year. So some cycles happen over 2 years, and then we have a later stage of cycle which just happens over a year, and these cycles overlap.
Mm-hmm.
Each programme is a mixed programme, so we have an Opus 18, a middle and a late. So we're not doing it chronologically, we're kind of having the more balanced programmes.
Yeah, and that will give the audience in each programme a sense of development as well of those pieces.
Absolutely.
That's fantastic. And you're working up, I know we're not allowed to talk about it at the moment, but you know there will be at a major London venue a complete cycle some distance in the future, a couple of years.
That's correct, yeah. London is one of our last venues. The kind of beginning venues we have in November and December are places like Southampton, where we're kind of resident quartet, Oxford, Reading, Bristol, we'll be at the Brighton Festival, Norwich, Whitehaven. We're also having a cycle in Glasgow, where we're also going to be resident quartet starting from next year. So, I mean, that's a selection of some of our venues, and some of them we've played there a lot already, we already have a relationship with, and other venues are completely new to us, and we'll be going there for the first time with this Beethoven project.
When you're playing, for example, a piece like Grosse Fuge, where there's an immense struggle kind of almost in every line, that's such dangerous music that it must never become safe. Eh?
Yeah, I guess we've played it a few times this year, and for me there's not yet a danger of that. I mean, it's so exciting. I find it really hard to just keep my cool, because of course we have to, you know, at least a part of the brain needs to remain, thinking.
In control.
In control. And it is a hard thing to weigh out the balance between it being understandable, so, you know, the structure and the themes, and staying crazy.
Yes, keeping control of uncontrollable music is one of the great paradoxes in music, I think, because creating that illusion that this is something that's unhinged, but at the same time not going off the rails.
Yeah.
I mean, it's fascinating.
He himself was going off the rails when he was writing it.
So we have to feel that. The audience have to feel it. There's an educational strand also to your Beethoven project. Beethoven cycle too. Tell us about that.
Well, this was really in the same feeling as the website. We wanted to, you know, try and bring Beethoven to our audiences. So by having educational elements, we're trying to involve as wide a range of people as possible. So we start with a a concert for children, and we're being joined by a presenter called Polly Ives, and we're kind of making the Beethoven quartets accessible, telling them a bit about us, a bit about what a string quartet is, a bit about Beethoven, covering some of his famous pieces like his symphonies or his Ode to Joy, and then also having excerpts from the quartets and trying to involve them in an interactive way, so using body percussion or clapping or whatever it's going to be. So there's an event for children. We're also presenting what we're calling lecture recitals, where we'll be talking about specific elements from the quartets and playing musical excerpts. And that could be for various levels. It could be for high school students or university students, or also just for adults who are interested. We're hoping to put these on at the venue we'll be playing in. And then we're also offering masterclasses or chamber music coaching, and that could be for individuals or for quartets. And the quartets could be pre-formed, or we might be trying to run some kind of course where we form groups and maybe we even play amongst the group and teach from the middle.
It's interesting, children probably respond to the big sound, you know, an orchestral sound. That must be a challenge for you to get them to really respond to the kind of leanness of sound that you're dealing in. Or not. Do you find that they're readily responsive to a string quartet sound?
I think what they also really respond to is closeness, and which is, I guess, what we benefit versus orchestras, is they can be really close to us and they can really sort of smell the rosin like an old teacher.
Like visceral feeling.
Yeah, and they can really see us and they can, you know, and ask us questions at the end. And so I think that's a real plus for us. And we can still make a lot of noise.
Live music is exciting. I mean,
regardless,
we've always found
that,
you know, kids just love seeing live music. I mean, it's a very physical kind of experience. And I don't know, I've always found them to be interested. But of course, with something like Beethoven, it's not the most accessible music. And so in that way, it's about bringing it to them in the right way, which why we've kind of put some thought into how to make it accessible for them.
And I suppose your passion will communicate, and on that note, I mean, as you work your way through these quartets, are there particular movements or quartets that you just love to play? Because sometimes there's a difference, isn't there, between, you know, pieces that you've got great respect for and that are very challenging, and those that you think, oh, I just love playing this. Is there a distinction like that in that?
For me, there are just so many of these quartets or movements that I love to play. I can't think of one I don't, to be honest. There are perhaps some particular highlights in the cycle. Beethoven's music is so incredibly spiritual and it's of such great depth. And there are some of the slow movements that, I don't know, are just beyond words for me, like the slow movement of 1-3-2, or the cavatina,
the cavatina,
opus 1-3.
Yeah,
they're just, and you feel it as soon as you're playing it live to an audience. You just feel something, you know, something unexplainable happen, I think.
Somebody once said that, you know, the difference between Mozart and Beethoven was that Mozart was very much of this world and of this earth, his feet, extraordinary though he was, but Beethoven was kind of cosmic, was somewhere else.
Yeah.
I mean, is that something you can relate to?
You can lose yourself with Beethoven, I find. You can forget where you are and who you are, and it does take you somewhere really remote. It's really soulful music in the real sense.
We've really found in our rehearsals that we've never had to kind of search so hard and deep for the answers to these questions that he's asking. I think, you know, we're really kind of going to the bottom of our stomachs to, you know, play this music. I think that's what it needs.